I thought the book read very well. I enjoyed it very much. I had one question. I know that your hero, the lawyer, has appeared in a couple of other books.
Four.
Four books. Total of four?
Mm-hmm.
What's the pronunciation of his name?
I pronounce it Tomasi.
Tomasi.
Some people say Tomasi.
Mm-hmm.
It's Armenian.
Well, we'll go with
the official.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about you, and then we'll work ourselves up to the touch of treason. I can see that you have a sense of self-promotion because of the press kit and all of the appearances that you've made in the past on various talk shows and this sort of thing. But I wanted to find out a little bit about yourself in some of the biographical data. You're quoted as saying that you were an author at the age of seven, so you must have had some ink running through your blood at a very young age.
I guess I did. That was a poem that was published when I was 7 years old. I think it was my second year of school. And it's probably one of the few things that I wrote when I was young that I still remember, but I'm not going to recite it for you. Don't ask me to.
You still have the poem?
Yeah, it still scans.
Where were you born? Where did you grow up?
I was born in Illinois, and I was transported to New York when I was quite young. I was about four, but most of my family's still in the Middle West.
Where in Illinois?
It used to be called Evanston, but if you look for it on the map now, you can't find it because it's merged into Chicago. Okay. It's up where Northwestern is.
Were you a New York City youth?
I was a Bronx youth until I went to DeWitt Clinton High School during its height of fame. Everybody who was on either the journalism or the literary side in that high school made it in some way or other. James Baldwin was on with me at the same time. We were co-editors of our literary magazine. I ended up publishing his first book of essays, Notes of a Native Son, many years later.
Oh, I'll be done.
I ended up in Manhattan just before going off to World War II and lived in Manhattan till the early 60s when I became a suburbanite, and you couldn't change me for the world now.
Well, you're still a suburbanite. What was your role in the big war?
I had an infantry company before I had a publishing company.
What happened after the war?
A very varied career. I taught for 5 years. I had a very lucky break in the Army in that I did something radical to change the Army educational system. And as a result, I got a college teaching job, though I had not yet had my degree, and I was able to simultaneously study and teach, and did that through my master's. I ended up teaching at Columbia and at the City College in New York, and then made it into the State Department, where I was the number two man on the ideological advisory staff, and I ended up with my own broadcast. Do you remember Raymond Graham Swing? You look too young, possibly, to remember him. Well, He dropped a gram when he dropped his wife, and he did a 6-day-a-week broadcast to England, Western Europe, and North Africa, and I did that broadcast on Sundays, and it was supposed to be cultural with just a touch of politics.
Did you write it or voice it or both?
I did both, and we had to invent a name for me because a number of Arab countries heard the broadcast, and they thought Sol Stein wouldn't go over very well. So we made up the name Kevin David, and I used to sign off, this is Kevin David in New York, and then when my first son was born, we decided to name him Kevin David. He was the first of six sons, but I only had the one broadcast, so we had to reinvent the names for the others.
Were you on the GI Bill after the war?
Yeah, the GI Bill helped a lot through graduate school, particularly.
Did you go to undergraduate school at Columbia as well?
No. I went to City undergraduate, Columbia graduate, and taught at both.
And you studied what, English?
I studied English, but that's not what I taught. The odd thing is that I was the youngest member of the faculty in the social studies department. It was a new thing then. I taught philosophy, political science, economics, history, anthropology, sociology. I was sort of like a floating back. That is, I would teach whatever they had a spot open for. So I was always about 3 hours ahead of the students. It was a wonderful way to learn a lot of subjects fast. I didn't get to teach in my field till long after, when I taught playwriting in the Graduate School of Columbia. By that time I was a playwright, and I was teaching something that I knew before I got to school.
Well, with such a diverse field, no wonder you were just right for the federal government, I guess. How long did you work for the government?
I worked for the State Department for 2.5 years, and I think that my State Department experience was very influential in doing The Touch of Treason. The whole background of predicting Soviet actions and then getting involved in studying Soviet espionage, particularly in this country, was what I got into in the early 50s. And I owe a very great deal of this book to the fact that the number one man at the ideological advisory staff was Bertram Wolfe, who was probably the greatest Soviet affairs expert this country ever had. And he burned to death at the age of 84. So you can see where the stimulus came for doing this book.
Mm. Nothing suspicious about that?
No, it was not suspicious. He had a bad habit of wearing a very flowing bathrobe in the morning, and they have gas heaters there in California. Locale is different, and the person is different, but it just inspired this. We, by the way, were recently, this whole habit of trying to study how the Soviets work and to be able to predict things came in very handy. We scooped the world on Gorbachev. On December 20th, I signed up a New York Times man to do a biography in a hurry, and we released it on May 8th. And 2 days later, Chernenko conveniently died, and the higher power organized the Politburo to get in 4 hours a new man in place, and that was Gorbachev, and we had the books on the stands.
Yeah, that's why you're president of your own firm.
By the way, I never had a job in publishing before that. That was...
Well, let's go back a little bit. We're not going to ignore The Touch of Treason, but I want to fill in some blanks and have a picture of what you are and who you are.
Okay.
You became a playwright. You had a lot to do with the founding of the Actors Studio, didn't you?
Not the Actors Studio, but the Playwrights Group at the Actors Studio. In 1957, roughly, Molly Kazan, who was Ilya Kazan's first wife, and Tennessee Williams and Bill Enge and Arnold Schulman and Bob Anderson and myself, there were 10 people who founded a playwrights group to work at the studio, and the idea was that we would develop scenes from plays in progress using the best actors in America who were members of the studio. And the interesting thing is that Arthur Penn recently read The Touch of Treason and called me up and invited me to come back and rejoin, and I did 2 weeks ago.
Oh, that's nice.
After long absence. Well, that was very exciting in those days. I had a play that was first done. It was a somewhat autobiographical play that was first done at the Actors Studio, and Darren McGavin played me. And then it was bought for production in London, and the producer and director and star, Kenneth Moore, started fighting, which is usual in the theater, as you know. And I decided to go back to peaceful New York, and I tried something I'd never tried before. I had written in every form except fiction. And in 17 days, I transformed the play into a novel, and I sent it out anonymously to 6 publishers, who assumed that this was Saul Stein, the publisher, submitting a book for paperback rights or something. I mean, they drew the conclusions. And 5 of the 6 made an offer for it. And that book turned out to be The Husband, and it worked very well. And so I sat down to write a real novel from scratch, and that was The Magician, which is now in its 2nd million. So,
were you at this time in publishing?
Yes.
According to the biographical data here, publishing came about as an accident. Now,
yes.
Where does this fit in exactly when you were with the Playwrights Group at the Actors Studio and with the State Department? Somewhere along the line did you begin publishing by accident?
In the early 50s, I had what might be called an economic idea. That is, there were certain books that I would have liked to see in print in paperback, and people were beginning to think about what they called then quality paperbacks. Now they call them trade paperbacks. And Jason Epstein was putting together Anchor Books at Doubleday, and I went to see his partner, Nathan Glazer, who's now a very distinguished professor at Harvard, and suggested a few books. In fact, the first book that I suggested was Bertram Wolfe's Three Who Made a Revolution. And he said, well, the problem is we'd have to reset it, and it would have to be three volumes, and the book has pictures, and we've never used pictures in paperbacks, and I didn't think it could work. And besides, in resetting it, we'd have a break even of 37,000 copies. There were all kinds of reasons not to do a book that he would have liked to do otherwise. So I thought, well, if one photographed the original hardcover book or used the same plates, it would bring the break even down below 10,000 copies if you kept the book the same size. So why not have a paper-covered book the same size as a hardcover book?
What they would call a quality paperback. Yeah.
There was a fish out of water, though. I must say, I remember when people thought I was crazy. I was told paperback's supposed to be a pocketbook, and you can't put the book that size in your pocket, and whoever heard of pictures in the paperback, and I priced Wolf's book at $2.95, and they said the highest projected price is $1.25. Nobody will ever pay $2.95. The book is now, by the way, I think $12.95 in paperback, and it has sold 900,000 copies in the intervening years. In any event, I packaged this idea up and drew up covers, and I went to one publisher who couldn't raise the money for it, and I went to a second publisher who in less than 3 minutes said, I'll get on a plane and come down to New York. And that was Mel Arnold of the Beacon Press in Boston. And that launched Beacon Paperbacks, and I was its general editor. And I think my contract calls me originator and general editor, and I still get royalties from that event 30 years ago. And I think the next, I was an advisor and a consultant to a number of publishing firms, to Bill Yovanovitch of Harcourt Brace Yovanovitch for a period of time. I brought him his favorite author, Milovan Gilas. I smuggled that first manuscript out of Yugoslavia. Again, I seem to have a penchant for doing that kind of thing. And then in 1959, I organized a very distinguished partnership. My partners were W.H. Auden, the late poet, Lionel Trilling, one of the great critics of this country, and Jacques Barzin, who was both a writer and he was then provost of Columbia University. He was also my Cupid. He was the one who introduced Stein today. I had been in their doctoral seminar at Columbia, the Trilling-Barzin seminar, probably the most famous course ever in this country. Great. They have 35 people come in and 8 are left at the end of the year. They're ruthless. And we became friends, and we formed a partnership to start a highbrow book club, and we formed something called the Mid-Century Book Society. And against all odds, it was a financial success by the end of the first year and was off and roaring. Pretty soon we found that about 50% of the books that we were picking were books that no publisher had previously picked. So we were, in a sense, taking a book to a publisher and buying back the thing that made him a profit. The obvious result of that was we wanted to piggyback a publishing operation on top of the book club. It ended up that we started a separate publishing operation, and that was Stein and Day 23 years ago. And Patricia Day, my partner, wife, mother of my children, is still today the hand at the other part of the helm.
Well, that opens all sorts of questions for me. Isn't it tough having a partner who is a business partner who's also your wife?
It sure is.
Scrap.
I don't recommend it.
I mean, don't you see enough of each other at home, and you both have to deal with each other at the office? Right?
There are problems, but there are balancing compensations. For instance, we are particularly strong in the British market. We probably have more authors of British origin than any other American-owned house as a percentage of our list. And I think that comes out of the fact that there are certain British authors, agents, publishers that I get on with and certain others that she gets on with. And so when we descend on London, we can go for a fortnight and come back with 13, 14 books as we did at the beginning of this year. And that's a great advantage, being able to function independently and do twice as much. Also, she supervises certain elements of the operation that I'm less interested in, so I think that works out well.
But do you ever have conflicts over what books to acquire?
Rarely.
She just hates it, you like.
Rarely. We have had them because sometimes I think each of us confuses something we'd like to buy a copy of with something that we think we're going to publish. One has to be very careful not to be over-regulated by one's own tastes and preferences. That doesn't mean one shouldn't publish things that you like. As a matter of fact, in my early years, that was all that I published because it's all that I knew. I didn't have any experience. And I'm happy to say 87% of those books are still in print. So obviously it was the right thing to do. But today, running a firm the size of Stein and Day, we were recently rated by the Writer's Yearbook as number 3 of the top 50 in this country, which is good.
In terms
good
of?
All from the writer's point of view. And the writer is the one who originates the material. All the criteria they use for selection are based on things that benefit the writer, editorial, promotion, so on. Author's involvement in certain decisions. And we find that working in tandem has enabled us to train a second generation that will keep the firm going. People who have learned from her some of the publishing techniques and others who have learned from me others of the publishing techniques. And now we have a group that's large enough to I think we can feel comfortable going away for a while and knowing that the wheels will keep spinning.
Why did you decide to move to the suburbs?
That was also a fluke. In 1973, we got a financial statement that showed that our rent was exactly equal to our New York City taxes. And the coincidence of those two numbers jumping off the page made us think that if we stepped across the line, we might not have to pay any less, but our tax situation would be much better. And we lived in the suburbs then, too, so that was something in the back of our minds. And very luckily, we, through a series of unbelievable coincidences, a man who had directed a play of mine on Broadway, Daniel Petrie, was the only man that I knew in Westchester, and he found the agent who found me my house, which was the first house I saw on the first day. And that agent became the man who, when I started to look, called me one day and said, hey, there's a mansion that's come free that's catty-corner across from where you live. We made the deal on June 11th and moved out on June 30th, which was the end of our fiscal year, and started operations.
You mean you walk across the street to work?
I don't walk. I drive. It's a 2-minute drive. I mean, you can't walk across Route 9 safely twice a day and expect to live very long.
So you drive 2 minutes to work?
I drive 2 minutes to work. I've had to walk twice in I guess, what is it, 11 years now, 12 years, when the snow was just too deep and the roads were unplowed. But normally I carry two briefcases with me full of reading, manuscripts, things I'm working on. So I just as soon not run with them. I used to do that when I went to New York.
Well, isn't it difficult having those multi-martini lunches at places like the Four Seasons? I mean, across the line, as you
I'm very glad not to do that. I think a lot of publishing energy is wasted in the 2.5-hour lunch 5 days a week. And I also think it's ultimately not a healthy way to live. You end up eating too much or drinking too much or talking too much or whatever. Up there, we concentrate on doing what we have to do. It's a very much more relaxed atmosphere. When we first moved up there, people said, gee, are people going to come? What about the book clubs and the paperback people and so on? Are they going to come visit you? And it turned out very quickly that we had another problem. They came up for lunch and stayed the afternoon. And it gets euphoric. I mean, the Scarborough House, which is a landmark house, by the way, it's an official landmark, has 12-foot-high ceilings, and most of the people have fireplaces in their offices, and it's quiet. And you look out the window, and you see a rolling pasture and acres of trees and a Stanford White church in the distance. It's very pastoral, and yet I'm less than an hour away from these microphones.
Approximately how many titles do you issue a year?
We have for quite a long time put out 100 new books a year. Most of them hardback, a few trade paperbacks, And in addition to that, now we're also in the mass market field. We're a completely vertical firm, and we put out about another 120 titles in that. So it's about 220 all told. It's a lot of reading.
Evenly divided between fiction and nonfiction?
No, we're pretty heavy in fiction, and heavy means maybe a third of the list. Most publishers would publish less than 10% of their list in, on the fiction side.
Mm-hmm. I see you have just reissued The Arrangement by Ilya Kazan. He was in, I guess, last week talking to me. And what prompted you to do that? It was a paperback of a book that came out, when was it, 1967?
Well, I think that was one of our great mutual triumphs. That is, Ilya Kazan's first book, America, America, was Stein and Day's first book. I mean, we
was that your very first book?
Yeah,
I have a copy of that. I didn't know that was your first.
Yeah.
I've been carrying the hardcover of America, America around with me for years and years and years.
I will always cherish his inscription in that book. He wrote, "Dear Saul, this is your book, Gadge." He really believed only in the movies in those days, and after the success of America, America, he sat down to write a real novel, and that was The Arrangement. And, of course, it was the biggest-selling hardcover book of the decade. It sold 917,000 hardback copies in its year of publication. It was a phenomenon. It was number one for 37 weeks, almost unheard of.
No wonder you could afford to move to a mansion.
Well, that was years later. In any event, that book was a colossal success and really solidified our friendship. We had been friends since the early 50s, I guess, but when you have a success that big, it's the best glue you can possibly have. We still feel that way about each other.
He's extremely grateful. He, as a matter of fact, also turns out to be a neighbor of mine. He was on the west side. And so he was absolutely delighted that you had done that.
I've got some news for you, then, that nobody outside has heard, as far as I know, which is that Frances Kazan, his new wife, has written her first novel, which she was very nervous about, and it's wonderful. It's called Good Night, Little Sister. And it's about the rock and roll world, and it's terrific, and we're going to publish it at the beginning of next year.
He's been writing for Knopf, or published by Knopf, his most recent books, but he is doing two books now, as I'm sure you know. One is his autobiography, and the other is one that he has decided how it's going to work out. That is, I guess it's a screenplay now, but it would fit logically in between The Arrangement and, what was the other one? The Anatolian.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, we don't want to talk about Ilya Kazan. I want to talk about Saul Stein as a writer. Being a publisher and a writer, does that cause conflicts at all?
It causes the opposite of conflict. That is, I think a number of the novelists who are with me, the successful ones, like working with somebody who does it himself, who's not just talking theory, who's been on both sides of the desk. And I find that the pros, the real professionals, like dealing with somebody who is not a frustrated writer, but somebody who gets his highs from writing and also edits books.
It's rather time-consuming to operate a publishing house and to write at the same time, isn't it?
Well, I stick to a pretty rigid schedule. I write every morning until 9 o'clock, and then I take one head off and put the other head on and go to the office in 2 minutes, and I'm a publisher.
Well, your latest book, of course, is A Touch of Treason. I felt from the very beginning that, although I was wrong, I felt that the young man who was on trial, his name escapes me.
Ed Porter.
I didn't feel that the state had a very good case against him, and I thought he would win. And he did, of course, win. But you made it pretty clear that he did do what probably shouldn't say all that on the air, so we don't want to give away the plot. But it at some point became clear to George Tomasi that he was defending a guilty client. And a good portion of the book toward the end deals with Tomasi's conflicts about this. And yet he went ahead and defended the lawyer. Is something that you believe is indeed typical of the legal profession that they would do this in mid-trial now?
Well,
They get new information.
Absolutely. Let me tell you, I know a great many lawyers and judges, and mainly because of my books, because Tomasi has now been in 4 books of mine, and since the first of them, I seem to have a special audience that consists of lawyers and their wives. And what the criminal lawyers tell me, and remember, that's a very small percentage of the 620,000 lawyers we have in this country, less than 1% who really practice criminal law exclusively. And it's sort of the pornography for the other 99%. They get their kicks out of reading about those trials. And what they say, what I think they like, is the fact that it's realistic. It's the way it really happens, as opposed to Perry Mason, where, you know, they have the good guys and the bad guys, and you know how it will come out from the start, and where a lot of the fighting goes on inside the judges' chambers and in front of the bench so that nobody can hear. And what I have tried to do is to put Tomasi into a double bind that lawyers and other people will appreciate. That is, most criminal lawyers have to defend people they know are guilty from day one, because that's what 99% of the cases are. What happens in Tomasi's case is he thinks he's defending a kid who might or might not be guilty of murder. What he finds out in the middle of the trial is that the kid is guilty of something much worse than murder, and something that really bothers him. Remember, he's the son of an Armenian immigrant who, you know, blessed being in this country, and feels very strongly about the subject of treason, and all of a sudden realizes that what he's defending is a kid who, like that Christopher Boyce out in California, turned against his father, his country, and everything else, and did something that was, in a sense, a crime against everybody in the country. And that troubles him a great deal. See, Tomasi's a winner. I mean, I think the reason women like him is that he is out to win. He plays hardball, and that's what he goes for, and I think demonstrates the fact that what counts is not how good your case is as much as how good your lawyer is. Mm-hmm. And this fellow, Tomasi, who is determined to win, I mean, he couldn't think of the possibility of losing, suddenly finds himself, for the first time, in a situation where he doesn't know international politics. His lover and lady friend, Francine, knows more than, she works at the UN and knows a great deal more than he does. And he, in his innocence, is suddenly on a platform in that courtroom, being watched by the world's press, television. There's even a defection that happens in the courtroom. And it's over his head. And what happens is he is torn apart for the first time in his life, and particularly when the opposition suddenly springs a surprise witness, and that witness is his own woman, and he knows he's got to march up to the witness box and tear her to shreds. His great conflict is between winning, which he must do, and tearing apart the person he most loves.
You gave us a red herring, though, when Francine was involved in the hit-and-run accident. Well, I guess it wasn't hit. Yeah, I guess it was a hit-and-run accident. Turns out that they were three drunks in the car, but that was a red herring, because I thought for sure that had to be linked somehow with the treasonous.
You are not alone. I have now talked to, oh, it must be at least 24 people who have come up to me and said, I read your book and so on, and said, you know, when that car crash happened, I was sure that the Russians were up to it. But the interesting thing is, and we shouldn't give it away, but the very ending of the book, which has to do with a car driving away, suddenly makes that previous episode meaningful. So it's not really a red herring. It's, let's say, the planting of an idea that then surprises you at the end.
You have written a very effective courtroom drama, primarily courtroom drama. You must have really picked the brains of your lawyer friends for this, huh?
Well, I studied law, not in law school, but at the feet of a friend of mine who's now a federal judge. I have a number of friends who are lawyers. F. Lee Bailey, some time ago, he's read this book twice, by the way, said that I was the leading unlicensed practitioner of criminal law in this country. One of the interesting things that happens now is I can be in a room with a bunch of lawyers and they discuss how would Tomasi handle the Goetz case, as if he were a living person. And I take great pride in that, because I think that a novelist's real job is to create people who who are more alive than he is, who will last longer than he does. And to have that happen where they consider, it's like saying, how would Sherlock Holmes solve so-and-so crime these days? To have lawyers talking seriously about how Tomasi would handle this and disagreeing with each other over it gives me a great deal of pleasure.
How did you happen to come across an Armenian hero? There have been no Armenians in fiction since William Saroyan.
I picked someone of Armenian heritage very particularly because most people don't know that the Armenians were the first Christians, and they also don't know that there was a Holocaust before the Holocaust, and that is the Armenian massacres of the early part of the century were terrible and resulted in the deaths of many hundreds of thousands of people, and yet it has escaped the notice of our history books to such a degree that people don't know about it. And in earlier books in which I use Tomasi, there's a great deal of that background. And I wanted to give him a kind of parentage and ethnic background that would, in a sense, give us a wider perspective of the kind of inhumanity that human beings are capable of. I think my primary subject is human nature, and I've got some pretty rough things to say about it. And I wanted to point out that in this century, it's been very bad for the Christians as well as for the Jews in terms of massacres and genocide. And by giving him that background and that feeling, I think it has helped me create the character that I have today.
I have a feeling we'll be seeing Mr. Tomasi back in the courtroom in the future.
Well, lots of people ask me to do that, and I really would like to write about other things, and every few books I get away from Tomasi, and I think I'm going to get away for the next one.
Well, thank you very much for coming in and talking to me about The Touch of Treason in Yourself. Oh, I did want to ask you one other thing. I noticed that I've been following the problems that Congdon and Weed have had in their bankruptcy and Publishers Weekly, and then I noticed in the paper that there was a benefit to help bail out their authors. That's rather unusual. I've never heard of anything like that, a benefit to help out a bankrupt publishing house.
I'd never heard of it before either. Actually, bankruptcies in publishing are almost unheard of because what happens when a publisher runs into difficulties is that he is bought by another publisher because the publisher's biggest asset are the copyrights, and they go on forever as long as the books are in print. So that that asset, though it doesn't show up on a balance sheet, usually tempts somebody to buy somebody else who's in trouble. And I think Tom Congdon was quoted as saying that there were people who were interested, but it was too late. He was in too deep. And
well, it's too bad that happened. Did you happen to see the article about Michael Korda in the New York magazine? It's got a picture of Korda with a cigar on a motorcycle.
My wife flashed it in front of me and said, you're not going to want to read this. I just want you to know that it's there.
Well, it's strange you say that because I had invited Korda in. He has written a novel called Queenie's coming in
yes.
a couple of weeks. And then I picked up the copy of Sunday of the New York magazine, which I subscribed to. And I read the article, and I'm not having second thoughts about it. I'm just not sure that someone with the sense of competitiveness, power, power keeps using that in a rather exploitative way fits in with my little broadcast, which is very literarily oriented. And so I don't have to give it some thought. He may be colorful. He may be a good thing to do.
I think we're working diametrically opposite, at completely different sides of the room, as it were. I'm just completing a nonfiction book called Courtesy, which has nothing to do with etiquette. And my friend Sidney Hook tells me there hasn't been a book on courtesy in 350 years, so I guess it's about time. I think you can see where my direction is pitched is very different in power and success. I believe we haven't paid enough attention to the needs of the people we associate with.
Well, it's obvious that you do have power and success. You have power because you accept books from people who want to have them published. and you have success. You've indicated that through your titles. But at the same time, I don't think that you have exploited this in the way that Michael Korda appears to have. And yet, that article indicated that he seems to be extremely nice and friendly. And it's just that I got scared when I saw it. I didn't know that was my kind of writer. But I'll find out.
Okay, sure.
Paul Stein, thank you very much for coming in and talking to me. And I hope we'll be able to do this again.
Good, I like it.